Welcome to the Commercial Matters Podcast. Your show host is Amit Kapoor, owner of Mindful Contract Solutions. Nothing in this podcast is intended to be legal advice.
Hi folks, welcome to another episode of the Commercial Matters Podcast. Now, if you have been following us since we began in 2021, you may recall that our first four episodes were basically my takeaways from a landmark tech outsourcing case, Cooperative Insurance Services versus IBM. Now, that case eventually went on to the Court of Appeal in 2022. And now we are recording this in 2024, but the principles that emerged from the case remain very relevant for all those involved in delivery and management of tech outsourcing programs. Today on the show, I'm delighted to have two very special guests who had deep involvement in the case as external dispute practitioners. We are going to be talking tech disputes, but more importantly, how you can stay clear of them. My first guest on the show is Adam Fortune. Adam is an experienced dispute resolution lawyer with Keystone Law and Punter Southall Law. He advises on a wide range of commercial litigation and arbitration matters. He has represented clients including FTSE 100 corporates, as well as private individuals on both domestic and cross-border disputes. Adam is particularly well known for his expertise in IT and banking. Adam qualified as a barrister in 2005, and much like a solicitor, he is authorized to conduct litigation. Prior to joining Keystone Law in 2020, he worked at Adel Shaw Goddard. Then at AG, he was a key member of the legal team acting for CIS, which was a successful party in the landmark CIS versus IBM case. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And my second guest is Jill Hunt. Jill is a technologist and acts as an independent expert witness in tech disputes. She has experience of over two decades in disputes ranging from £100,000 to £500 million, litigated in various venues, including the Technology and Construction Court, the Court of Session, and arbitrations. She also assists with disputes involving intellectual property, copyright, and patents. Having gained experience on both buy-side and sell-side of tech contracts, she can see an IT problem from both points of view. She was instructed by CIS in the CIS versus IBM case, and indeed she features in most of the prominent IT disputes in this jurisdiction. Jill, great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Amit.
Before we get into the thick of it on how to avoid disputes, I would like to focus a little bit on why is it that disputes are to be avoided? And I want to start with this because when I have worked as a contract manager on programs, I have often seen, you know, buyers especially take a very aggressive stance with suppliers when things go wrong. And I've often wondered, do they really understand what they could be up for if this thing was litigated in courts? So if you can help us bring it alive for the audience, a standard dispute when it goes to litigation, what kind of cost and time commitment are we talking about? Adam, would you like to have a stab at that? And then we can take Jill's view as well.
Sure. So as ever, it depends on scale of the project, scale of the contract and so on. But I think the answer, broadly speaking, is expensive, both in terms of money and in terms of management time. And I think in particular, it's the management time that can really surprise people before getting into disputes. The anecdotally, people know that litigation is expensive and the costs go up every year as they are with everything else right now. But the thing that clients tend to remark on with me is that they didn't realize how much of their own time they would have to invest in conducting the case. And that's because I'm not sure if it's fair or not, but there might be a perception that when you instruct lawyers, there's a feeling that you can, let the lawyers get on with it and we can go back to the day job. And of course, as lawyers, we are completely dependent upon instructions from the client to understand what the case is, what the points are that we want to put across, and the tone that we want to set for the dispute. We won't set any particular tone that the client doesn't want us to set, whether that be aggressive, whether that be conciliatory. And it's really important not to underestimate the amount of management time from a variety of people across the business horizontally, and that sort of vertical impact as well. It's everyone from the board of directors through to the executive, through to middle management, all the way down to people who you really want to be deploying productively on business projects, who have to be diverted into dealing with disputes and instructing lawyers. And because, you know, we all specialize in, as you know, as you pointed out, I'm a finance litigator and an IT litigator. That's not to say that we know everything under the sun about finance and technology. There's always something to learn and there's always something to be taught. And that's a lengthy process. And so, you know, you're talking financially in terms of fees, it can run into the millions for legal fees for the bigger cases. And in terms of management time, I mean, you're talking weeks to months of commitment dispersed over a period of time. But that's really what you're talking about in terms of time commitment. So I think those would be the two things that I would highlight as being the real impacts of getting into a litigious dispute.
Oh, that's very helpful. And Jill, do you have any further comments on that?
I agree with Adam. It's a very expensive and time-consuming process. And I think people don't appreciate quite how far down the tree you need to go in terms of the program managers may understand that they'll be involved, but often you have to come down into the technical architecture level to people who are running individual work streams. And not only are those people then not able to do their day jobs when they get sucked into the litigation, which is a very peaky approach. It's not a smooth project type of approach that you have in litigation. It's very much things have to be done when they have to be done. The other challenge I think companies have is the turnover. So quite often those key people will have moved on to other projects, so that you'll have to drag them off those projects in order to work on litigation, or they may have left entirely. And that can leave you with gaps in the litigation process and challenges in your other work. So it's not something to be entered into lightly, I think.
No, and actually just building on something that Jill's just said there in terms of program managers moving on to other programs, they can also move on to other companies entirely. And so a lot of your evidence can have walked out of the door before you've ever developed a dispute. And then when, you know, the board who are divorced from the sort of the day-to-day realities of business turnover sort of say, right, now's the time to go into litigation. Where are the witnesses? And people have to turn around and say, well, yeah, they left, you know, 6 months ago, 8 months ago, and, you know, then you're looking at sort of cooperation clauses in contracts. But once they're out of the door, it's very difficult. There's no property in a witness is one of the sort of central tenets of civil litigation in the English courts. And it's very difficult to get people to cooperate and give their evidence when they've moved on to do jobs with other companies. So, the other thing I would add as well is publicity and reputation. Bigger cases, this tends to impact. You get press coverage, and that can be industry press, which is bad enough, but it can be national press as well. And it's very, it can be a difficult thing to manage the sort of the PR piece around your ongoing business when the papers are constantly reporting on developments in the case.
And because you touched upon this aspect of people walking out of the door, can you give the audience a sense of how long might it be from the point a dispute is, you know, crystallized to the time it's actually in the courts? What kind of time frames are we talking about, roughly?
Just going from the sort of the technical legal point of view first, you have effectively 6 years from the time at which an issue develops, roughly speaking, under statute of limitations to bring a claim. So it can be up to 6 years. Practically on the ground, I think Jill's probably got a better sense for, you know, the time between issue arising somewhere and people who need to know getting to know about it.
Well, there's that, and there's also the time from when you've pushed the button and said we want to litigate to getting to court if you go the whole way. So if you take Cisco IBM, that terminated in 2017 and went to court in early 2020. And that's relatively swift, I would say, for a dispute on that scale. But it oddly, the time it takes is not necessarily commensurate with the amount of money involved. Even relatively small disputes can take just as long to litigate and cost almost as much, because of it's more to do with the length of time the project has been running,
right,
and therefore the amount of efforts involved.
Yeah, and I'm also reminded that this was before the COVID backlog hit the courts. So it's, if anything, indeed, it's probably going on the higher side than that. So that's very helpful. And I know programs generally like to budget for things in terms of time and usually costs. But is it very difficult to form any realistic estimate of what litigation might cost until you're really far down the process? I mean, can you give a sense of when do you feel comfortable informing the program of what it might cost to take it to the court?
I'm not sure one ever gets completely comfortable. Even, you know, the day before the trial, you tend to become more reconciled, I think, to a margin of error in one's estimates. But I think the first time that you really get a sense, a tangible sense of how much something is going to cost, is when you are preparing for the case management conference, because that's the point in the proceedings at which you're starting to really think about, you know, who are the witnesses going to be? Who are the experts we need? You know, do we need more lawyers potentially? How many documents are we facing in disclosure? What sort of technical challenges are we going to face in evidence gathering, generally speaking? You'll get a trial date set, and that's going to be a number of months, if not years, away from the date of the case management conference. And if your dispute is valued in the bracket, which off the top of my head, I think is up to £10 million, you're subject to what's called the cost budgeting regime, where you have to actually sit down with a pro forma spreadsheet and cost out the fees it would cost to bring the case to the conclusion of a trial. And that really does focus the mind on how much everything is going to cost. And you really get a sense then as to what the numbers are going to look like. And I have to say, having done that exercise on a number of occasions, having started off quite against the idea of cost budgeting, more and more I think it might be a beneficial thing to roll out to disputes of even larger proportions, because there is a real control point around spend that comes with that exercise. And then if you're thinking about, you know, when a case management conference is in proceedings, that can already be years into the dispute, having been identified by the first letter before action, let's say. So you're already, you know, you are some months, 2 years into the dispute before you have that first real tangible sense of realistic estimates, I believe.
Yes, and I'm just reminded by my recent study on dispute resolution. Case management conference usually happens well after the letter of claim has been issued, all of the pre-action correspondence has happened, and the defense has been issued. And you then get a date from the court, which is several months after the defense is when it happens. So we're clearly looking at least a year or more from the time.
Exactly so. And it's when what we call the pleading practice is closed. So particulars of claim have gone in, defence has been done, replies and responses, if needed, have been filed as well. And I have a case on at the moment, which isn't an IT dispute. It's a private equity dispute where it was issued over a year ago now, and we're still amending pleadings. So we haven't even had a listing for a case management conference yet. So that gives you an idea of the sort of timescales you're dealing with.
And from an expert point of view, I might have done the majority of my work by the time you get to the CMC.
Because it's true.
If it's very technical, then you need all of that advice and all of that material put together before you can properly plead the case. And if the pleadings is a big battle, which they often are in these cases, and there are lots of request for further information for more details of the technical issues in the case, you may well have spent really quite a lot of money before you get anywhere near a CMC.
No, that's very helpful. So it's amply clear that disputes are something to be avoided. So I just wanted to get a sense from you as to why disputes happen, because you're seasoned dispute practitioners. When you were instructed, do you have any heuristics around the areas you got to look for? You know, the usual problem areas in programs that might be the root cause of issues. Do you have a sense of that, having worked on a number of disputes? I mean, Jill, do you want to have a stab at that first?
The root causes are different in different disputes, but fundamentally, it's usually a mismatch between quite often both parties' expectations as to the amount of time involved and the amount of money involved, and the reality. So I sometimes refer to it as a kind of an excess of optimism on both sides. You know, the client wants something done very quickly. They have a fixed budget. They may even have a fixed end point because of some other issue that's going on in the company. And the supplier obviously wants to win the business, and they will commit to do what the client wants them to do. And usually the root problem is that it just isn't feasible in the time that's been allowed or for the cost that's been allowed. And depending on the relationship between the parties, that may turn into just a longer, more expensive project than you expected. Or it may turn into a full-blown dispute. A lot depends on how the process of the project is managed.
That's very insightful. Adam, do you have any further thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's. I would absolutely 100% agree with what Jill's just said there. And in particular, the sort of the optimism piece is a real point at which disputes can arise, in terms of, you know, the buyer always wants more for less, and the vendor, I mean, I don't want to mischaracterize either party, frankly, in that relationship, but you know, the vendor is a subject matter expert in what it takes to deliver what's being asked for, and wants to cost that up and then put some margin on top of it, and those interests, you know, they coalesce, but they're in a corridor, and that corridor can widen, particularly as the project goes on. I do wonder sometimes whether disputes can be caused by an over-reliance, and this is going to be an odd thing for a lawyer to say, but an over-reliance on the contract. A lot of the times, one or other party will say, well, no, we've got a contract in writing. It says it's got an entire agreement clause and a clause and, you know, no variation to the contract without writing. In the writing, it says XYZ, and we shall not depart from XYZ. And the issue with that is the contract was drafted on, you know, day one minus however many, and then you've got to whatever it is in the project, and there can be such a mismatch between reality and the contract that it's not necessarily helpful to give the contract primacy over an ongoing relationship between the program managers on both sides of the relationship, who are seeing things very differently, potentially seeing a solution a way through which might involve a little bit more money here, a little less deliverable there, or what have you. And I think it's sort of it's that moment where if you start using the contract as a weapon, that feels like a moment where you've gone from a collaborative relationship into something a little bit more contentious. And that's a moment, I would say, that if you're starting to find yourself reaching for the contract in your discussions, it's a moment to be very careful, I believe. You know, not saying anything about the merits of any particular situation, but if you're relying on the contract, it might pay to just take a pause and think, you know, is that necessarily the way forward in this particular circumstance? You know, not to get blinkered by the documentation, I suppose, is a way of putting it.
I think that's a very good point, if you're using the contract as a weapon. But by the same token, if, as often happens, people just ignore the contract, then quite often things are not done in the way that they need to be done in order to encapsulate whatever they're arguing about and get it sorted out. There is a temptation on a client's side, and I confess I've done it myself as a client once or twice, to just let the supplier run with an issue that I know they're probably going to turn around and turn into a change request. But if the supplier chooses not to do that, then I can just pretend that it hasn't happened. So there's a balance to be struck between operating the contractual mechanisms to make sure that things are properly dealt with and not just brushed under the carpet, versus, I know, throwing out delay notifications, you know, every week to make sure you keep the customer under the cosh, for example. Point blank refusing to ever sign off a change request or a specification because you're trying to push the supplier as far as you can. So it's about using the contract, but in a measured and sensible way and accepting that there are, as you said, there are times when reality and the contract have just diverged to a point where really you just need to sort out this particular problem and then everybody can move forward.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. It's that balance, isn't it? Exactly so. It's exactly so.
And well, one of the things I have kind of seen in many of the outsourcing programs is often because technology is a fast moving area, by the time an outsourcing program is seeking to deploy a product, the product itself might be coming towards the end of life and the business themselves have moved on and wanting to do different things. Is that something you get to see in the instructions you ever get from buyers, especially about them wanting to do something different and therefore wanting to extricate themselves out of outsourcing contracts that they are locked into?
I'm not so sure about wanting to extricate themselves, but certainly wanting to make sure that they take advantage of whatever the latest wave of technology is. And the nature of large procurements is they're quite slow. So it can take quite a long time to get to boots on the ground, as it were, by which time your chosen product may already be slightly behind the curve. And it's a real challenge in technology to work out which products to decide to go with, particularly as some of our larger tech companies have a nasty habit of deciding to change their strategy without telling anybody. So you can find yourself basing your strategy on a product that's available but not as supported as you thought it was going to be. And I think that's something that clients and suppliers have to be mature about, recognising that there are things the supplier can't help, and then just looking for a way forward rather than, again, getting into a battle over something that maybe they can't do anything about.
And how often have you felt, you're obviously a technology expert, but how often have you felt that the issue with a program dispute is to do with the technology itself, as against with the people, information, governance involved in it?
I mean, obviously it's about the technology and that the technology is the thing that expresses and is the thing we're trying to build. But it's very rare for the technology itself to be completely the root cause of the problem. Much more often it's, we didn't realise how big our problem was. We didn't realise how complex this industry was. We thought this industry was like this other industry. We thought the UK was like a different country that we've just come from. It's about complexity most of the time, and that includes technology complexity and people complexity. Whatever the problem was, it's just more complicated than we thought, and it's taking longer and costing more. Specific technical issues are very rarely the root cause. It's much more about controlling complexity, finding a way through it, and not letting it take the project off course too far.
Yeah, I would endorse that absolutely. I think the technology poses the question, where do we go from here? And the dispute, in my experience, tends to arise when there's an inability to answer the question, where do we go from here? And that there's no value judgment in that at all. It can be for all sorts of really complicated business reasons why two parties to a contract just can't see their way to a negotiated view of the world, and that's when they need to call upon more formal, you know, depends on how you characterize litigation. One way might be to look at it as a sort of very formalized negotiation mechanism all the way through to, we just need to get a third party called a judge in to, you know, cut up some rough justice between us because we're just out of ideas. But yeah, it's that sort of, it's the inability of the people, I think, to answer, come up with an answer that works for everyone. Where do we go from here, given the technology difficulties we find ourselves in?
Hmm. And Adam, because you look at contracts even outside of IT, I thought, you know, your view on this might be helpful. I've often felt that outsourcing programs are actually a joint enterprise. You know, it's not just the supplier doing bits. There's a client side team, there's a technology vendor, and there's so many other ancillary contracts that make up for a successful program. Do you find it unusual or peculiar in IT contracts that a supplier, and it's usually systems integrated, takes an enormous amount of risk, although it's got a number of interdependencies. But is that unusual to IT that that kind of contract structure exists, or is that normal across other sectors that you work in?
It's a good question. Given that my sample size is a litigious one, if that makes sense, my view of the world is skewed by the fact that I'm tending to see the documents the problems. I'm not sure I could sort of give a view on that. It is an interesting question. I think one observation might be, I really like your characterization of a large procurement contract, you know, systems integration contract, or a sort of software as a service contract, as a development contract, as being a joint venture. Because in a lot of ways, that's precisely what it is. And when you look at the documentation that goes into your more typical joint venture relationships, let's say, you know, a private equity fund, for example, the documentation in establishing a fund is monumental, and it's all about prescribing the democracy between the parties, who gets the vote on what, you know, what issues are put to vote, how do we move our way through a dispute, all of those kinds of things. It's really, really detailed provisions in terms of governing the almost people relationship that's at the core of a successful fund around the asset of money, if you like. And certainly I sometimes look at software contracts, or I look at systems integration project contracts, and it's very heavy on the technical detail, and you know, there's lots of mechanisms in there for, you know, change requests and so forth. I don't know whether there might be scope in the future for incorporating a few more of the democracy type concepts from joint venture documentation, you know, committees. I'm sure, I mean, I'm speaking out of turn because I'm not a transactional IT services lawyer. So people might be listening to this and jumping up and down and saying, yes, that's always there. That said, in the ones that I've seen that tend to go to dispute, there isn't much of it around. Equally, it would be sort of foolhardy to advocate that more regulation and prescription around behavior is the answer, because I mean I'm not sure that's necessarily the case at all. That said, you know, really thinking about the delivery and the procurement of the contract as being a joint venture, and thinking about what that really means in terms of what we need in the document to manage difficult conversations, I think is a good thing.
I mean, I think that's the idea of democracy in a outsourcing contract, I suspect, would be quite radical. But I think it's an interesting concept, because one of the challenges is that clients and suppliers are often trying to manage their own risk and to make sure they haven't taken risk that they can't handle. And obviously there are some, particularly in the kind of more complex contracts, which are not really systems integration contracts, they're more these tower contracts where you have different organisations delivering different chunks of the technology, with sometimes a delivery assurance partner across the top. You need a mechanism that makes sure that all of those parties do what they're supposed to do at the right time. And I think that's one of the facets that's missing from a lot of outsourcing contracts. It's not sufficiently explicit. It's not really done in a way that works. And then you have a dispute resolution process, which quite often doesn't involve a neutral third party, which is really what you need in order to get through some of these. If you have a 10-year outsourcing project, you can't just terminate it once it's running. It's getting out of it is a challenging thing to do. And I think we need more attention paid to things like early neutral evaluations, adjudication or third-party dispute resolution, that just doesn't involve escalating it further up the management chain and having those people talk to each other. You need Solomon to come in and say, well, you can have half of it each, guys, because that otherwise the parties just aren't able to get through the problems.
Have you been involved in any sort of early neutral evaluation type thing? Even a sort of, I know the commercial court has provision for it. Maybe the TCC does as well, in terms of you get a judge to sit down with some papers and give you a sort of a steer as to what the court thinks about the merits of the claim.
Only once or twice, and that's been more looking at the result of an E&E that resolved a problem but didn't resolve later problems. When there is an adjudication service that the Society for Computers and Law has put together, I've not been involved in any yet, but that's a good candidate, I think, for a process that parties could use to say, well, we're in flight. The outsourcing deal it may not be working perfectly, but we're kind of well underway. Maybe we should just put this particular problem to a third party and get them to help us sort it out.
I can see we've already segued into the last section of this call, which was around tips of avoiding disputes. So it's great to have solutions-oriented practitioners. So I think one of the things that I have seen in the programs I've worked on as a contracts manager is what really works well is when one party decides to let go its accrued rights and call for a reset. You know, just be open to the fact that this contract is no longer deliverable. So let's start with a fresh, clean slate. Is that something you tend to kind of get involved in, or Jill, probably more for you, because you tend to get involved early compared to, I think, Adam?
It really depends. I do get asked to, quite often it's advice before they get to a contract reset. So it's, we're in this situation. This is where we are with it. Help us work out whether the things that our technology people are telling us are right. Are the things that we've done that we shouldn't have done, or that the other party's done that they shouldn't have done? Trying to work my way through what I would refer to as the project myths that tend to grow up as to why things are in the particular impasse they've arrived at. We all have our views as to why things have happened. One of the odd things about litigation is that quite a lot of that gets swept away, and quite often you wind up fighting about completely other things. But really just trying to get to a position where people understand the situation they're in, and that may well then lead to, well, actually what we need to do is now raise a CCN or do a contract reset of some description in order to reflect the new reality of where we've got to. But not always. Sometimes I'm not involved until much, much later.
Well, that's very helpful. I think you touched upon this earlier on, Adam, when you talked about some behaviours in programmes. So I just wanted to kind of drill that a little further. Is there a pattern of behaviours you observe in programmes that are litigated and that end up in courts versus those where, you know, parties might settle well before things get to court? I mean, is there something that our audience can kind of reflect upon in terms of behaviours they should exhibit when in a dispute?
When you say behaviours to exhibit, you mean signalling to the other side that, yes, we're in dispute, but we would be open to a negotiated solution?
In terms of how do we position ourselves? I mean, one approach would be to, as you said, stick with the contract and, you know, just ask that the contract is followed to the letter. And the other being open to kind of resolve issues and be open to even reset it and let go accrued rights? Or is there a middle ground? Is there something other than these two behaviours that might be required?
Yeah, it's a difficult question to answer in the abstract, but generally speaking, by the time that I'm involved, that will be usually around the time that someone has decided that a letter before action is necessary, or indeed a letter before action has been received, or lawyers have broken onto letterhead, as we like to say. You know, we're starting to write lawyer to lawyer, you know, not necessarily a letter before action, but, you know, here's a letter telling you how angry we are about the whole situation, and so on and so forth. And I think if you find yourself in that situation as a client, you almost have to, if you're committed to that course of action, you have to you have to ride two horses at the same time. It's that sort of old adage of, you know, speak softly but carry a big stick. It's you do have to absolutely insist on, you know, having devil's advocate, having said earlier on in the piece, like, you know, when you find yourself reaching for the contract, that's the time sort of for a pause and step back. If things are just not progressing in the conversation space in the way that you would wish, then absolutely reach for those contractual provisions and stand by your rights and your view of the contract and what was required of you or of the other party. And at the same time, having open a, what we call a without prejudice channel to the counterparty. Without prejudice basically meaning the court would never see it. And it allows the parties to make concessions as to their position that would be damaging to their case should the judge ever hear it, but might allow a commercial resolution to be achieved between the parties. It's a difficult balance to strike as to how much stick and how much, you know, speaking softly. That ultimately is a call for the client, really. They have the background of the relationship, they have the background as to the business reasons why they entered into the contract, whether it be as vendor or whether it be as procuring party, and they have the best sense of their own corporate culture, if I can put it like that. How do we tend to conduct our business? How do we want to be seen in conducting our business? Do we want to be hard-nosed? Do we want to be seen as conciliatory? And we as lawyers will sort of encourage the client to think about those kind of things and be congruent with them in terms of creating that balance between insisting on what you think your rights are and having that without prejudice conversation and seeing what can be done on the commercial side of things. So it's a sort of not one size fits all, but it's an iterative process as well. You change that as you go. It's not working. You might want to try something else, a bit more aggression, a little less talking and vice versa. And that's something that really experienced litigators get. You get a feel for it. And indeed, you consult your experts as well. We'll certainly consult with Jill to get her sense of where is this? Where do you think it can go? You know, there's a sort of way in which there's an unconscious language spoken, you know, between parties. And sometimes as lawyers, we don't necessarily pick up on the subtext of what's actually going on. And that's where experts can come in and just say, look, I think this is what they're saying. You know, by the way they're behaving, their body language in this scenario tells me that X, Y, Z. And that can be all sort of built in that iterative process.
And that's quite helpful because it... Go on, Jill.
I was going to say, I think in parallel with everything Adam was saying, I think the other key thing from the live contract management and or program management angle of things is the importance of prioritising things. All of us are very good at saying, well, that's my top priority, and then realise that by the time you finish talking, you've got another dozen top priority items that you've raised. And I think the reality of these large contracts is that there are times when people's complaints about whatever's been going wrong turn into a vast array of complaints, not all of which are as important as the others. And I think that's a real skill for a good program manager or a good contract manager, is to home in on the stuff that is really important and actually make concessions on the stuff that's perhaps not quite as important. And you may need technology help or you may need business help to understand which ones really are. But it's often, again, it's back to complexity. If everything is top priority, the project will get bogged down in the complexity of it. Whereas if people are able to take a mature approach and say, well, actually, these 10 things are absolutely top priority, these ones are a little bit less priority, and these ones we can actually live without. Obviously, if you can't live without any of them, you have a big problem. But I think that mature sense of prioritising what matters in the contract is how you avoid disputes, as long as both parties can bring the same quality to the table.
That's indeed very helpful, Steer. So I appreciate that, Jill. And actually, that actually leads on very nicely to the next question I had. So as a contracts manager, I do see a number of disagreements on program. but sometimes it's not always evident that something might need external advice. In your kind of sense, when is it, what kind of disputes really require a contracts manager to escalate it to an external litigator or an expert? I mean, who do you escalate to first? Is it a solicitor? Is it a expert? How do we deal with dispute? How do we pick up what the early warning signs are? I mean, again, I'm asking this in the abstract, but any pointers would be.
I mean, I think you know you're in dispute when you've asked for something a number of times and it's not been forthcoming from either party. So if you're a supplier and you've asked for a change note, or you've put a change note in and got no response, you probably know you're going to be in dispute. And as a client, again, if you believe that something is in scope and you've been told it isn't a few times, then you're getting into that territory. I mean, my view would be you actually always need both the legal advice and the technology advice. I see people sometimes getting technical consultants in who proceed to ignore the contract. So although they give potentially useful material, it doesn't sit within the contractual structure. And equally, contractual advice by itself, if it's a complex technical dispute, may not be enough to get you the answers.
Well, that's very helpful. And final section of this podcast was about just engaging with externals. So what is the best practice in terms of engaging with an external solicitor, barrister, or an expert? And programs often have this perception that all we need to provide them is a narrative and access to the repository of documents and correspondence. Is there more to it? And what kind of structure would you like things to be provided to you in? Perhaps we can start with Adam yourself first and go to Jill.
Yeah. So building slightly on your question previous as well, in terms of once you realise you're in dispute, and I'd absolutely agree with Jill in terms of those sort of classic red flags. The other one I would add is when your lines of communication start changing and people that you were talking to previously, suddenly you're not allowed to talk to them anymore and you're not quite sure why and it's all a bit odd. And sometimes it's a bit like a feeling you get, like, that, you know, yeah, are we still friends? What's going on? You know, it's that kind of feeling. That's the time when you start thinking about, I would say, not necessarily going to externals, and sort of this builds into your last question, which is if as an organization you have internal legal team with litigators, that's probably the time to start involving the internal litigators in what's going on. If you don't have internal litigators, maybe get your preferred external counsel instructor just to be on a watching brief in the background. And the reason I say that is because you have to start becoming very careful about what you commit to writing about the ins and outs of the project and who you think might be in the right and who you might think might be in the wrong. You don't necessarily want people putting their views as to, you know, we could have done a lot better ourselves here, frankly, in writing when you're trying to sue the other side, because that all gets disclosed if it's not covered by privilege. In terms of getting those external lawyers involved on that sort of softer mandate to help you with issues around privilege and what have you, which is what I'm sort of loosely referring to there. Some companies have panel arrangements, so they'll go to their favorite firm, and there will be some prescription already in place around the instructions and the manner in which the firm would like best to be instructed. It isn't so straightforward as here's all the documents and here's a quick note and away you go. It's meetings, it's briefings. We lawyers particularly tend to understand things a lot better once we've had a chance to speak to people and ask questions. If we're given stuff to read, we'll just read it. And so you immediately run up a bunch of whip. And we are further forward, but we're not as far forward as we can be if we sit down with someone who has lived and breathed the project. Oftentimes, I think, as Jill says, that should be alongside a technical expert as well, together to get a living briefing as to what's going on. And I think that meeting component is really the bit where, you know, the more in-person time you can have on it, the better. And that allows a dynamic conversation to take place.
And there is absolutely no substitute for getting probably half a dozen of the key, on a big project, half a dozen of the key people, technologists and program managers and contract managers, all in the room together with some lawyers and some experts, because so often people have technical conversations which are relayed up the tree and which get mistranslated. It's like Chinese whispers. So it's very, very difficult for a senior program manager or contract manager to fully understand what the technical people have been talking about. And if you can unlock both that and also the contractual stroke legal issues that an external litigator is going to want to know about, and explain those to the technical people at the same time, you can cut through really quite a lot of misconceptions and problems in both directions, and make progress much faster. And you may well find you understand the dispute much better than if it's done in a piecemeal, you know, one-on-one fashion over the course of several weeks.
This has been very insightful. So thank you so much, Jill and Adam. I mean, I'm conscious we've reached about 45 minutes into the podcast episode, which is about the optimal length of a podcast. Is there any final thoughts that you wanted to share before we draw this to a close, either of you?
I think I would just say that if you go into litigation, both parties have lost, and that you should, from the beginning of a contract, try and focus on making it a success. So the client has not got the system they wanted and the supplier has not got the profit they wanted. And you need both parties to engage and try and focus on a win-win, which is to make the thing work rather than, as Adam said a few minutes ago, beating them over the head with the contract, which may still be necessary, of course.
Yeah, I'd echo that. I would echo that, because oftentimes you'll go through proceedings and if you win, you get damages, but you don't get the product that you contracted for. You don't get the project delivered. You just get your money back and then, you know, business losses potentially. So it's a win, but not as you wanted it when you started the project. So I would absolutely agree with that. And I would add a counterpoint to that, which is sometimes you do have to fight, because you just can't not. You can't let it lie there that you are being taken for a ride. I'm not saying that that's every case, but there are cases when it's time to fight. And if it's time to fight, then absolutely go at it and fight. It's time to do it. And again, that's you get a sense of that on the ground. And you iterate towards that. It's not a decision to be taken lightly, I think, even then, even if all that's left is to fight, it's still not a decision to take lightly.
That's great. Thank you, Adam, and thank you, Jill. Really helpful, and I'm sure our audience will really enjoy this and also hopefully make contact with you. So both Adam and Jill can be contacted via LinkedIn. We have included the link to their respective profiles in the show notes. So thanks again, Adam, and thank you again, Jill.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for the invite.
Yeah, likewise.
That's this week's episode of the Commercial Matters podcast. Don't forget to join us next week for another episode. Thank you for listening.